This is the first of a series of four talks on women and religion. And today, we're going to be primarily talking just about culture. And we won't really get into too much of a little bit about women, but mainly about culture and how it forms us. It will set the, hopefully set the tone for what we'll be doing in the next sessions, which will be dealing with the myth of feminine evil, the myth of feminine inferiority, and then contrasting Luke's Mary with Proverbs' ideal wife. So let's begin by talking just in general about culture. We as human beings are rather distinctive animals. If you want to have kind of a continuum, you can put one, there's one on the board. In terms of, in many animals, instincts control their behavior. Their genes program animals how to act. For instance, octopi. You get baby octopuses, or octopi, I guess it can go either way. They're born, and their parents, their mothers and fathers, don't have to teach them how to be octopuses. They know. Their genes tell them. I don't know if their parents protect them for a while, but they immediately swim off and do their octopi thing. Now, as we start getting toward more complex nervous systems, if we look at animals, we find out that more and more there's a gradual development where animals have to learn how to act. Learned behavior replaces instinctual development. For example, birds have to learn their song. Now, for the longest time, they thought birds had their song imprinted in their genes. And then they found out that the little birds, when they're still in the eggs, learn the song. And if you sort of nurture the eggs without the parents around sitting on the eggs and singing their song, they won't know how to sing their song. They'll sing, but it won't be their own song. And so unlike salmon, who know precisely where to swim to spawn, the birds have to learn their song. Now we, as human beings, have to learn a heck of a lot. Take little babies. They don't know how to be human beings. We have to teach them. That's why we spend so much of our time educating our youngsters, teaching them how to act in ways that is appropriate for our behavior. Now, it's not obvious to children that they should wear clothes, say I knew rather than I knowed, that's what my nephew always says, or even eat with the spoon and fork. Huh? You know, that's a trick they always pull on people like me. I chose not to marry. I don't have any youngsters. So when I visited my niece, my brother and sister-in-law, when their little kids were just at the age where you put mashed potatoes and gravy on their face, it was always great fun to have Aunt Joan, you get to feed them today. Yeah, you know what it is. I mean, it seems obvious, second nature to us, when we sit down to eat mashed potatoes and gravy without even thinking about it. We reach in with our forks, right? Guess what my niece and nephew thought you ought to do? You ought to go boom, because it feels so good, and you ought to rub it all over your face, and then you ought to throw it at your nice aunt that's feeding you, right? Okay, so we condition people to act according to our cultural norms. And this is very useful, because it enables us to cooperate. Holden Village couldn't run for 5 minutes if we weren't all conditioned to act according to cultural norms. And we do it so it becomes second nature, so we don't even think. How many of you had to make a conscious decision to sit down right now instead of turn a somersault? Now, when you were 3, I'm not sure it would have been all that obvious that you ought to sit down and not turn somersaults. So we all act almost second nature. So in a certain way, we can say who we are, our behavior is limited because culture creates us. It programs our behavior. It programs us. It tells us how to be good people so we can get along and cooperate. Now, this has a great many advantages over the animals whose behavior is determined by instinct. For one thing, we can change with the times, right? We have a great deal of adaptability. Some animals become extinct, or often become extinct, because their environment changes and they don't have the flexibility to change. Just recently, within the last year, the lake that feeds into the water supply of Los Angeles fell quite a bit because Los Angeles was losing too much water. That meant that a certain insect couldn't breed, and over 100,000 birds died because they came to feed on those insects, a particular species, and they didn't have the flexibility to find other insects to feed on. You know, they were programmed only to eat that one kind of insect. It gives us a great deal of adaptability. Human beings can live in almost any climate, from the Antarctic to the tropical rainforest. Our behavior is not inevitable. We can change it. Certain male animals fight over their mates. They have to fight. Now, similarly, we can say, well, gee, we've always had war, or we've always had sexism, or we always had racism. But we know we don't have to. We have a flexibility we can change. It's very hard to change because our behavior becomes almost second nature to us. Now, I think we see this immediately when we have people that have lived in other cultures. Has anybody had some experiences they'd like to share about? I've traveled in Canada, and that's about it, in the United States. But how about any of the rest of you? Have you traveled in other countries where you've had difficulties getting along? Yes?
I've been in Sri Lanka, West Africa, Greece, France. These are the ones I'll just give you an example of how my conditioning messed me up.
Yeah, it really messes us up when we try to deal with people who have been conditioned differently, doesn't it?
In West Africa, in my culture, I was conditioned if you were not a size 8, you were, you know, out of the norm. There, if you are an 8, you are sick. So,
thick.
Sick.
Oh, sick.
You were ill because you couldn't eat enough. So, from one day I was in one culture, the next I was in another culture, and the whole approach to me was one of total acceptance, and I was sought after. And having been feeling the other way, all of a sudden, just like that, to be on, you know, the one to be the first one picked up on a taxi stand, as opposed, you know, they say, we want that one. and their premise was, if I was round, then I had to be wealthy to be that way. So it's also that they have many wives, so to have a white wife is wonderful in your collection. So I just learned to be very, you know, I used a sense of humor and said, you know, I'm very demanding and I don't think you would probably want me in your harem. And so I learned to deal with humor. Another situation being in Paris, I just was wearing my jeans and cruddy clothes around for a while, my very touristy clothes. And the reaction the next day when I decided to put my heels and dress on and act like a lady was phenomenal. I mean, people came out of the woodwork. It was that they really have a very high regard for a female who will dress up. The most important thing out of all these cultures is that our culture has sold us a bill of goods about being sex symbols to the world. And that many of the men of these cultures believe that we are very easy. And they expect us to be easy. I was in Greece, and a ship captain said, well, I'm not going to hurt you, but that's normal. You know, this is normal, and you won't have a good cruise if I don't help you, you know. And I was going, you gotta be kidding. He said, no, American women come over here to have fun, and that's their idea of what fun is. So we send these young girls, I'm particularly concerned about 18 to 25-year-olds, who go over there totally naive with the same cultural biases that they are to be after, you know, to be sought after and to have all these things that we tell them in our culture is very important. And they're totally naive and they will do certain things, they will say certain things, they will act certain ways that will cause them to have a lot of trouble. And in that way, this cultural bias is really detrimental to us.
Yeah, Americans have often been highly criticized abroad because we seem to think that everybody ought to act like we act, and we have often showed a great lack of flexibility in terms of adjusting to other people's cultures. Has anybody else had any experiences traveling abroad?
I would say, in response to her comment about what's expected of the American woman, that many times the American woman will put herself in a position to be thought of in this way, too. In other words, that's what some are interested in, that kind of a good time. And so it gives everyone, for all American women, that reputation, particularly if you're not accompanied by a man. If you are, then you're left alone, so to speak. But if you're traveling on your own or whatever, if you're on your own, then I think they see you in a different way.
Has anybody lived, has been a missionary or anything?
Well, I lived in Europe for 11 years, and I guess that's what I based what.
Isn't
all that much different in many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like Africa or the Far East. But this was mostly the Mediterranean area.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe the one thing I noticed was how very chauvinistic European men are, Southern European men in particular.
Yeah, I've had, yes?
Well, in comment to what you just said, I'm from a Spanish background, and so my dad, I didn't get paid until I was 17, and yeah, I was just very, very secluded and protected, but my brother, at the age of 12, was told he was a man and was allowed to go to parties, and in fact lost his virginity at 13, and if you could say that it was a virginity, but you know what I mean, at 13, and there was just a tremendous double standard there that was very hard for me growing up to understand, much less accept. So there was a lot of tension in our house because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same thing, very chauvinistic.
How many of you went to the talk that David did on time? Okay, that's again this kind of sense of our view of time being formed very much by our culture and what we expect. And I think you would, he contrasted a white person's time with Navajo time or Native American's time, which is a very different concept and often causes people a hard time to get along. We even have that in America. Haven't you had some culture? I had a little bit of a culture shock as I moved around the country. I was raised in Wilbur, Nebraska. And Wilbur's a small, great big metropolis of 1,360 people. And I think about 1,359 of them are from Czech backgrounds. And so I grew up thinking everybody ate Ethanetsa, Yelita, Kolachki, and danced polkas. I mean, don't you all? And as I grew up, you know, the Czechs tend to be a little boisterous people. You know, I don't think it's in our genes. I don't think I have boisterous genes. I think, you know, this is just what I learned as I grew up. My first teaching was in Massachusetts, where I taught in an Irish Catholic school. And I was around a lot of Irish people, a lot of Italian people, and a lot of people, Jewish people from the East. I fit right in, because they tend to be pretty boisterous too, right? You know, and argumentative, and you know, those are the kind of people you're talking to. When I'm talking to an Italian, you really wouldn't know if we're having a boxing match or a conversation as we talk. Well, then I moved to Moorhead, Minnesota. Okay, you get the little different picture, right? A little different culture, for those of you who have had that experience of going from one culture to another, even within the United States. Now, that's one of our problems with culture, is it can create a great insensitivity to people whose cultural backgrounds are different. We saw this, I think, one of the most horrible examples of it was at the time when Europeans settled the United States. At that time, it wasn't the United States, of course. But they found people that had a different culture. Native Americans, Indians. They had a nice culture, but it was very different. What did they call them?
Savages,
okay. So the sense is, your culture is not like mine. You're savages. It also, we realize that we need to have culture so we can all cooperate. So we can be very, very unkind to people who march to a different drummer. You know, many people are ostracized from our culture or treated badly just because, you know, they don't buy in to everything that we think they ought to buy into. Now, I think one of the examples of it that I remember very well when I was in graduate school was all of the concern about the long-haired hippie freaks, quote, in freaks. Very nice people, many of my friends. And I figured out in Wilbur, the hippie was a long-haired man or boy from the next town they didn't know because they could tolerate the long-haired boys or men in our town because everybody knew, you know, he was Otto Zajcik's son, and Otto Zajcik's a good guy, so Buddy must be a good guy, but you get to the other person. And so you get this great hostility to people who have different values within the same culture. And I think this happens because we realize that in order for us to continue to survive, we have to transmit our culture, right? If we don't, we have chaos. Now, that's a real advantage of the animals that live here. I know of many revolutions in American societies. Have you heard of one revolution in a termite colony? Just one? No, the termites do everything they're supposed to do by genes. And so there's no sense of revolution. Now, another thing I think that causes this trouble is that sometimes in our cultures, or very frequently, as culture programs us, it teaches us stereotypes. Stereotypes to put people in pre-arranged boxes of what we think they ought to be. Now, most of the next sessions we'll be talking about men and women, so let's talk about some other groups today. And let me give an example. I grew up in Wilbur, Nebraska, I told you, down to 1360. Most of the people were Czech. Where do you think I got all my information about Africans and American Indians? I never met any. Where did I get my information? What do you think? I had information about them as I'm growing up. Well, the school didn't teach us much, and the books, I guess there were some books, but I think I got more someplace else.
Hearsay,
that was important. And probably every Friday night, my dad took me to the movies. Okay, what kind of images, what kind of knowledge did I learn about Africans from the movies that were around? I was born in 43, so you can figure this is in the 50s. What kind of images of Africans did I get from the movies?
Tribes,
okay.
Negative.
Very negative. What ways would they be negative? What was the stereotypes that the movies were presenting at that time?
Wild.
Uncivilized. Okay, their culture was different than ours, so they were uncivilized savages. What else?
Less intelligent, possibly.
Less intelligent, that's right. What else? You saw the movies. What?
Slave material.
Well, yeah, you could understand why slavery would develop, because they weren't as intelligent according to the movies, and they were bloodthirsty, perhaps?
People to be feared,
except for the good Africans. And what do the good Africans do?
House servants.
Now, they were house servants to the attractive white settlers.
Or Uncle Toms.
Yeah, Uncle Toms, okay. They would be very attractive, you know. And so I would go and see the Mau Maus in the movies, you know, being these superstitious, you know, all these horrible stereotypes. Going and hurting these white people who were always very attractive, you know, Gabriel, yeah, what's his name? Robert Taylor Clark Gable. You know, all these really attractive people. Now, it was only later that I began to realize that in the Mau Mau Wars, about 1,000 blacks were killed for every white. Who were the savages? You know, yeah.
There's a saying in Africa that white man always has a number. You'll have a passport number, social security number. Somewhere, someplace, you are on somebody's computer. If you disappear, somebody's going to ask a question. Black man does not have numbers. So if they're, you know, they're killed or die or whatever, there'll be another one tomorrow.
Well,
there's just huge numbers of them that do not have a technical...
Yeah, they don't have computers, but they have very close family ties. So it's not that they're irreplaceable. I think that's kind of, you know, life is very valued in the sense of mothers caring about children, and it's a kinship family structure. And so I think one of the stereotypes that I, the people tried to sell me during the Vietnam War was that people from Oriental cultures didn't care about death very much. Did you hear that? They really didn't mind dying. And I think one of the things that broke that stereotype for me was watching television and seeing the funeral of these supposedly uncaring people, you know, and seeing the family cry and cry and cry. You know, again, that was a stereotype that our culture perpetuated, I think. So as I grew up as a little kid, my mommy and daddy, I don't think, had any massive plot to make me into a racist. I don't think Hollywood had a massive plot to make me into a racist. But just by growing up as a child and learning, I learned lots of things. I learned how to eat with a fork. I learned how to salt my potatoes, and now I've stopped salting them. I learned how to throw a baseball. I learned how to say no instead of nude. I learned how to step to the right if I ran into somebody. All this was second nature to me. And I also learned to become a racist without even realizing it. Because all my knowledge of Africans came from those movies. All my knowledge of American Indians came from those cowboy movies. My dad liked cowboy movies, so we saw a lot of cowboy movies. All my knowledge of black people came from those movies. And, of course, books and other things. Now, notice in terms of books, what do you think, when I saw books, what kind of messages were transmitted to me subtly? Those of you who've had, if people can remember the books, they're trying to get a little different now. But at the time when I was growing up, who were the doctors in all my books I read?
White men.
White men. Who were the pastors? Who were the lawyers? Who were the nurses? White women. Do you think I caught any messages I'm growing up? Sure, men do one thing, women do another. What were the black people doing in my books and in the movies?
Menial jobs,
that's right. And do they like to do those? Sure, there were two kinds of black people in the movies, weren't there? There were some that were just horribly victimized by stereotypes. Remember Charlie Chan's chauffeur? What is it, the horrible stereotype, those parts that come of the black man? Not that there's a good black man that's surely Temple's butler, but not him, but the others. Superstitious a little bit? Huh?
Violent.
Violent? Witch doctors? Okay, how about American blacks? What do they like to eat?
Watermelon.
Were they afraid of ghosts? Were they bright? No. Okay, except for the guy that was Shirley Temple's butler. Remember him? Very attractive man. What did he like to do? He liked to tap dance and wait on Miss Shirley. More than anything else, he liked to tap dance and wait on Miss Shirley, right? How about the attractive black women? Who do they look like in the movies? Can you think of any image for the black women that was sort of held up as the good black women in all the movies?
Lena Horne?
Or
Aunt Jemima. I was thinking of Aunt Jemima, and who would more than anything else love to cook for Miss Shirley. You know, now who else gets stereotyped? Now we'll be talking later on a lot about men and women getting stereotyped.
Mothers and fathers.
Okay, mothers and fathers in what way? Okay, we add television, you know, a lot for our conditioning. And don't forget, all these movies, Hollywood isn't really making such overtly racist movies as much anymore. But they're all on television now, so a new generation of kids are seeing them. You know, so I became a racist without thinking of it. Who else might I have, other than men, women, or racial minorities, might I have adopted distorted views of just because of the way I was conditioned? What? Okay, that's a racial group, right? Orientals?
Well, farmers, like Ron Paquette or...
Okay, farmers, there might be some kind of stereotype of farmers going on, right? That one didn't really catch me much, because Wilbur's a farming community.
Me too, but then
and
I realized that.
Yeah, so I think people in the city, that might have bothered. I mean, I knew the people, my aunt and uncle, who were farmers, were not Ma and Pa Kettles, but that could have been it. How about dwarfs?
Yeah.
And midgets. What do we say about dwarfs and midgets, just in the way... What would I have found out about dwarfs and midgets? Okay, freak shows. How about Snow White? Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Yeah, I mean they're sort of silly kinds of people. Or how about handicapped people in general? Did you ever notice how horror films often take a cheap shot by building on terror, by always having the villain be the handicapped person? Igor with Frankenstein. Wasn't it Igor? Yeah, the Hunchback. Now this is what did that do? I still don't know. How many have a good friend, you know, who's a dwarf or a midget? Yeah, see that formulates how we think. And it's very subtle because it's forming us, it's programming us. And it would probably influence how we interact with people, even though we don't recognize it. We think with our culture, not about it too often. Okay, can you think of any other group? How about the elderly today? Are there any subtle messages with regard to elderly people today? Are they stereotyped?
Sitting in a nursing home or something like that, a person sitting in a chair in a nursing home.
Okay, very few elderly people are in nursing homes,
that's
by
right.
the way.
Right.
Okay, what other stereotypes? Well, how about our advertising? What does our advertising say is the good way to be?
Young.
Yeah. We worship youth, right? I don't know, somebody says something like $5 billion a year on diet age, looking AIDS and everything. Well, we're all getting old, right? Huh? It's downhill from 21. People talk about bad birthdays to talk about how this got ingrained in me. And, you know, people say, well, the 30th wasn't bad. The 50th was really rough. You know, have you gotten into those conversations? Mm-hmm. Well, my worst birthday was my 22nd. Since then, I think it was so bad that I was really depressed because it seemed like I was going downhill from there. You know, I'd reached the epitome and now everything was downhill. I was sort of had this big image of turning toward death. What do we do? I mean, how perhaps much of our problem with the stereotyping of elderly people. This is a real scandal in the United States, I think, today. Okay, does anybody have any other groups they think get stereotyped? Yes?
I think there are two of these, like stuttering and quirky kids.
Okay, how about if I stutter? And what would the cartoons, in terms of stuttering, do to my understanding of who I am and how you might treat me? Or how about phrases like, I jewed you down? Did you learn that when you were young? I jewed you down. Does that transmit certain kinds of stereotypes about what we would expect from Jewish people? Very subtle, this stuff. Very subtle and can be very destructive to people. It's destructive to us if we're not the stereotyped ones, because then we can't interact with these people as real human beings, but all we're seeing is a stereotype. Even now, there are few attractive roles for handicapped people on television. Ironside's the exception, right? Not the rule, and he's off the air now. You know, how does this form us? And what it does to the people that get stereotyped is then they internalize it. Not all of them. But they can internalize it and feel inferior. One of the saddest stories I heard, and it was a black man speaking in the 60s. And he came across his little girl, his little, not his girl, it was his sister, I think, one day. In the bathroom, and she had Babble or Comet, you know what I mean? You know, that really hard cleanser. And she was scrubbing her face and it was bleeding and she kept scrubbing. And he said, what are you doing? I want to be white.
Oh.
You know, so this little girl scrubbed her face. Now that's why people, movements like Black is Beautiful come out. You know, it not only teaches us about the fallaciousness of our stereotypes, but it also helps people who have been discriminated against. He say, hey, look, that's not who I am. That's not what I am. I am a real person. I am a real person.
Can I interrupt you for just a minute? I understand everything of what's being said, and I agree with what you're saying. For the most part, that this is the way, you know, our culture is formed. But for instance, you mentioned, you know, Porky Pig and stuttering. I had a tremendous stuttering disability when I was about 10 years old up until about 12, to the point where I could not even answer the phone. And I can remember sitting back and enjoying Porky Pig and saying, hey, you know, it's okay, and he's in that cartoon and everybody loves him and it's okay if he's stuttering. That's one point I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is things like, why is it that I feel so warm and good and very nostalgic and sad that such programs as Amos Candy and Charlie Chan are no longer around? I never looked, you know, and it's still to this day, I don't look down at the people that were in that. They were like family almost because I enjoyed seeing them. So is it possible that there is a commitment to who those people are and making them more real? I don't know, I just really had a very great love for Amos and Andy.
Okay, I think...
Likewise, Lucy.
I love Lucy.
Know, here's a white show where, you know, she's real funny and she does all the zany things.
Well, I think nowadays we can look... There's been a difference. I think the real difference in the movies was that there certainly were dumb white people on television. I wouldn't grade the Three Stooges as being acting like Einstein, or who are some of the others? The Marx Brothers and that kind of stuff.
Laurel
and Hardy, right. There were certainly there were white people like that, but there was also the Clark Gables. And there were a variety of different things. Now, up until the 60s, you had no roles for blacks, except the dumb, superstitious black, and the good black that waited for white on white people. And I think that's where you get the real demonic thing, you know, destructive, is that, and again, how destructive is it? Well, the stereotype of farmers, a mom, pa, kettle, I mean, that wouldn't... My friends were farmers. Of course farmers weren't like that. I knew farmers. But how about dwarfs? I didn't know dwarfs. Or midgets? I didn't know midgets. Or handicapped people? I really didn't know handicapped people. I didn't stereotype epileptics as much because there was an epileptic boy in our town. And I knew he was okay when he didn't have a seizure. And so, again, how much these stereotypes will influence us will determine on kind of our other experiences. And I think, you know, and there's individual differences, right? And I get a little suspicious, though, when Charlie Chan's butler is always black, and his eyes always pop out, and he's always afraid. You know, Charlie Chan, of course, is a very competent individual in the Charlie Chan movies.
But his son was kind of zany, too.
Yeah, but then that was a balance, wasn't there? And his son was sort of in between. There was Charlie Chan, who was the good guy. His son, which is either number two, number three, or number four, it didn't matter, you know, because it's always the same kind of character. But then he was always a little brighter and a little braver than the black chauffeur.
No.
Well, the ones I've seen, yeah.
Kind of moving on to something else, is when I was thinking of a story of when I met my conditioning straight on for the first time, when I know that my Nebraska suburban background was in direct confrontation with another situation, in which I was proven that nothing terrible was going to happen to me, was I was with a black man, and he had regular visits to Sandstone Prison for a black identification group. And I was the only female and white in that organization, and it visiting there, and I felt so safe. And all the things that I've been told were going to happen to me did not happen. And it just broke all kinds of feelings for me, because I've been told that if you get into this situation, negative, negative, negative is going to happen. Now, I'm a little dangerous because I don't believe that anymore. So I will go into situations in which I've been programmed to think danger, danger, danger.
Well, you can get to, I, for a while, found myself in sort of a reverse stereotype, where the only blacks I knew were blacks that were in college, and would tend to be leaders, because at that time there weren't that many blacks in these white schools I was going to. And so I can't expect that blacks would be much better than whites, you know, and so we gotta, you know, so I'm sure I haven't freed myself from my stereotypes. I sometimes get caught in them nowadays. And when we deal with men and women, boy, we're really talking about, you know, we're going to be dealing with a lot of personal stereotypes that I'm sure influence me and influence us, both men and women, just as these stereotypes influence both blacks and whites. And, you know, and it's, but let's talk a little bit about what you're mentioning now, how we get out. Because here's what happens. We're programmed by culture, but we have the great flexibility, right? Somehow, what we have to do, we'll talk about freedom, is that we create the culture. And if we don't like it, we can change it. But it's very hard to change, because I really, growing up, thought that's what Africans were like. My other information on Africans would be looking through pictures of National Geographic, which tended to be giggling because women didn't have their breasts covered, as little kids tended to do that were conditioned like me. That was all my, I didn't have any, nobody in my school taught me sensitivity to other people's culture. I think I can really say that, or if they taught it to me, it didn't catch. So how do we gain this freedom to get rid of our stereotypes? Okay, first thing is, in terms of, one of the things that comes out is in terms of personal encounters, right?
Exposure.
I'm not...
Exposure.
Yeah, exposure. I'm not going to get... Now, sometimes, if I already have a stereotype, I can't really see the person. I just see the stereotype of who that person is, and that's a real problem. But, for instance, I'd never buy the Ma and Pa Kettle thing of farmers, because I knew too many farmers, you know? Wilbur's a farming community. Okay, that's one way. How about I can't meet everybody? What would be another way of meeting people? Reading. Books written by other people's perspective. Novels written by black people. Autobiographies written by black people. There's just so many good ones around, right? I think the middle class has a lot of stereotype of people in poverty, both in the United States and abroad. And I think we inherit these we're taught these stereotypes. Well, why not read Child of the Dark? Child of the Dark is the autobiography of a woman trying to make it in a Brazilian slum. It's a diary. Might be in the bookstore. Or A Welfare Mother is another title. Or have you read anything by James Baldwin? Or Ralph Emerson? Sometimes you can get a real different perspective, right? Yeah, so that's another way. Yes?
Well, it seems to me, though, that that won't work in all cases, because one of the problems is that some of the, groups that we're talking about have taken on the stereotype themselves. Mm-hmm. So that if we expose ourselves to them, we don't learn anything different about them. Women, for example, have grown up in our culture feeling they are a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so if I relate with them, I'm going to get that back and believe that just as strongly.
Yeah. Well, that's why one might want to read perhaps some of the women that are questioning the stereotype, you know, and read the quote, and I know for some people it's a bad word, it's not a bad word for me, but feminists. You know, what are they saying? Now, sometimes they're going to get you angry. You know, I know that. But then, you know, when no one asks, why are they angry? You know, and autobiographies are very good that have some reflective insight on what has happened. Have any of you ever read the autobiography of Malcolm X? I think the first 100 pages are really excellent. After he starts, I got a little bored when he started saying how great Elijah Muhammad was. But he was able to reflect back on his experiences as a child, and how one of the chapters is mascot. He was living with the white family, and they called him nigger all the time. And he said, later I found out I was a mascot. I didn't realize it at the time. And that's one of the things, and that's why a woman sometimes form consciousness-raising groups, which is simply to try to understand how I as a woman have been formed. And some men are doing that now, too. And there's a lot, you know, it's a really difficult thing to try to get us out. And we're never going to be completely successful. You know, I think these stereotypes. But reading and, you know, it's a real effort, and I think it's an effort that we all have to make. Now, what we want is freedom to create something else. And that's what, one of the things I think that is very useful in this, and this sets my own bias, is discussing how myths or stereotypes have been transmitted through culture. And the next time I'll be doing the myth of feminine evil and the myth of feminine weakness, trying to say how it's influenced both men and women. Now let's try to each sort of get a sense now and get to the issue of men and women, which is perhaps the hardest issue of all the stereotyping to deal with, because it's so important to us. Who we are as men and women. You know, that's part of our major identity, and it's very threatening. But let's see in terms of our culture programming us so we can create something else. And I think we first have to become aware of how we're programmed. Once we become aware, we can make a conscious decision to go along with it. Because the historical studies are very good, you know, to study that. I think I got out of my thing on Africa, or gained sensitivity. I don't want to say I got out of any of these stereotypes, because I think it's, I don't think it's one day we have and one day we don't. But reading a lot of history about the settlement of Africa, about the Mau Maus, about the settlement of North America. Who are the savages? Let's see, that started out with 1 in 2 million Americans. I think somebody told me the population dropped down. I thought it dropped in half. By 1900, it was, somebody said even less than half, 20,000, 50,000. You know, just horrible, not just by wars, but, you know, by diseases and everything, starvation. Now, if we're going to pick, let's try to get some names. Now, by our culture, what can we say would be the ideal man and the ideal woman? Not by your own personal beliefs right now, but by our culture, right? Bombarding us?
Right now or whenever?
Well, let's say, who would get put if we would take a poll on the most respected man and the most respected women? You know, you have these polls every so often. Who tends to get named?
Powerful.
Powerful? Well, how about some ideas? Now, do you remember any of those? Who are the most respected women or most respected?
Most respected.
Names.
They're always president's wives.
Okay, president wives. Presidents get here, right? And then often presidents' wives get here, you know, or ideal woman or most respected. Okay, that's one that almost always gets there, right? Reagan would be on there and Nancy would be listed, right? Anybody else?
Or maybe someone like Margaret Mead.
Okay, you do get somebody like that once in a while, if they know about her, who goes a little bit against the grain, doesn't she?
Florence Nightingale,
okay. Movie stars. I don't know if I can be Florence Nightingale. She's dead now, right? let's stick with people that are alive. Margaret Mead, is she alive?
Yeah, she just died.
Well,
she's Jonas Salk.
Jonas Salk, okay.
Okay,
the Pope always gets on. Movie stars for men and women. How about Mrs. Kennedy? Does she still make it, Mrs. Anastas, or not anymore?
Astra, athletes.
Astronauts. How about athletes for men? How about for women?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Do they get listed on the list?
Sure, they do.
Are they now listed?
Of course.
Who's a famous woman athlete?
Billie Jean King.
Okay, Billie Jean King, right. Tennis stars.
Chris Evert.
You're right. The tennis women are now making it.
Look at Wilma Randolph, she's been respected for a long time.
Okay, she was an athlete, wasn't she?
Right, a black athlete.
Wonderful. Okay, who else? I wish I had a list.
I just read one in Good Housekeeping and Phyllis Schlafly was on.
Okay.
Anita Bryant is also on.
Anita Bryant?
Gloria Steinem.
Was Gloria Steinem on there too?
Not on the one I read, she's been good.
She's been on other. Probably in this, but not Good Housekeeping.
Okay, we're starting to get different kinds of things, we're starting to get diversity, aren't we? I think often though, and we are getting diversity here, often they have been, the ones that I saw, I think were about, the men had always done accomplishments. And women, about at least 50% of them were the wives of accomplished men. Mm-hmm. Mother Teresa would be on here now, I think, wouldn't she?
Yes.
What?
Princess Grace.
Yeah, Princess Grace was both the movie star and the wife. Royalty, Queen Elizabeth always gets on here, doesn't she? Inherited. And I think generally today, you know, we're starting to get some diversity, but I will say maybe, would you agree with about half of them are wives of successful men? What are the men like that make it?
Decisive.
Leaders.
Wealthy.
What are the traits of the men that make
intelligent.
It? Intelligent.
Strong.
Strong. Decisive, men that accomplish stuff. What are the traits that would be associated with the woman now, that's certainly?
Trailblazers, for one thing.
Okay, you get some trailblazers on.
A few.
They're sort of almost like the token trailblazer on every list, right? That's what Margaret Mead gets on there, right?
Yeah, or service-oriented.
Service-oriented, that's where Sister Teresa gets on, particularly after winning the Nobel Prize. I don't know if people heard about her before that.
Supportive.
The helpful wife gets on there a lot, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm. Physically attractive.
Physically attractive women. Is that as important for men?
No.
Almost.
Good.
Well, I always noticed that in college, you know, they always have something like the homecoming queen where you had to be beautiful, and then they'd have the ugly man contest, you know, that was the leader in the Greek system. You know, and he didn't have to be attractive. You know, it was more of his leadership. Now, is that just the University of Nebraska, or was that elsewhere?
They elected a fake as homecoming king or queen or both of the universities.
Yeah, well, that's now they're just satiring the whole thing, aren't they? That's a satire of it.
I think some of that depends on the age that you're looking at your ideal man, ideal woman, too, because when you're 22, you're going to have a different attitude than when you're 42.
And how's the attitude going to change, do you think?
Well, I think that they're very much impressioned yet at a younger age, and I think that when you get older, while you step back and live a little bit and know how to look at these things and how to evaluate it.
Or you've got new distinctive rule of thinking, and I know some older people, there is no changing.
Right.
Yeah, I think it can go either way. I think you can go either way. You could gain, I don't know if it was me or my grandmother, but after, she lived to about 85 or 89, and after 80, she became very, very wise. Now, it might have been that I became the age, and she was one of those people that gained a great deal of flexibility, you know, and it might be I love my grandmother very much, and it was particularly after she became 80 that I became aware of her great wisdom. And it was just a delight to talk to her because she had that kind of flexibility you're talking about, you know, able to see things, a tolerance of other people that would surprise my aunt sometimes, who would be, you know, she just was a beautiful woman. And I, you know, again, it's probably I changed and was able to appreciate it. Maybe I learned not to stereotype her. But people can also get, as you get older, you get more, particularly if you spent your whole life doing something and living a certain way, and it seems that people are attacking that way, you get very defensive. Well, now, if we want to talk about male and female relationships from a Christian perspective and move that way, and then the next two times, I don't want to get into it now, but I'll just say what all this has to do with what we'll be doing, is that the next two times we'll be talking about certain kinds of attitudes toward women that I think prevent what we want, and that would be love between men and women. I'd like to, partnership, a book by Liddy Russell called Partnership. But let's, I think we need, if we're dealing with this, to define love a little bit, because I think it's been misdefined, and I'll be using a book, a definition that James Nelson has in the book Embodiment, a very good book. It's found in the library, or it's found in the bookstore on sexual ethics that also deals with male-female relationships. A very excellent book by James Nelson, Embodiment. And he says, love is the binding, the reunion, the coming together of two individuals so that the individuality of each person is preserved, respected, and valued. Love is the binding, the reunion, the coming together of two individuals so that the individuality of each is preserved, respected, and valued. Okay, so love would be something, words we could that would be appropriate to this would be mutuality, interdependence, respect, and partnership. Now let's maybe use some examples of what love is not. Say I'm having a hot romance with a man, and we decide to get married. Clearly, it would not be love if I expect him to conform to all my wishes, desires, and do everything I want him to do. For instance, I assume he will give up his job and move to Granville so he can be with me. I'm going to assume that he will stop supporting Reagan and start becoming a liberal like I am. He's got to give up his atheism and become a Christian. He's got to stop fishing, because that's very boring, and take up horseback riding, my new hobby. And more and everything, he's got to stop eating cheese. I can't stand cheese. I've managed 2 weeks of a hole in without eating cheese. And eat good food like broccoli, asparagus, and roasted chicken. And never again will he watch football on television. Rather, he can watch documentaries. Those are quite nice. And a few comedies like MASH. Now, I think you'd clearly say I'm not trying to get a lover, a husband, or a friend. What I'm really looking for with this man is not a love relationship, but he's totally conforming everything to me, and I don't have an equal, a mutual relationship with the man. I've got a well-trained puppy doggy. Slave-master relationships cannot be love. No mutuality is there. Now, clearly, it wouldn't be love if the reverse is true, right? If it's immediately assumed that I will give up my job, move from Granville to Texas, if I stop being a liberal and start supporting Reagan, if I give up my Christianity and become an atheist, if I decide that the riding horses is terrible and start fishing, and if I manage to force down cheesecake 3 times a week, and if I watch 20 hours of football on television every week, yuck. Now that wouldn't be love either, would it? I would become his well-trained puppy dog. Now, when I was talking to this with a student, she said, are you saying I shouldn't give all my all to my man? I said, of course you give your all to your man if he gives his all to you. Mutuality, partnership, respect for the individuality. Now, has that been what our culture has been conditioning us to think is the way we ought to have relationships? My students, if you know, we always think that we're getting better, right? And you know, racism is a thing of the past, and sexism is a thing of the past. When I try to illustrate what love relationships really mean, this mutuality, this respect, it doesn't mean that you always get your own way, does it? It means you work out compromises, right? So each of you live a mutually fulfilling life, right? That doesn't mean that one person can't have the job and one person take care of the family. It only means that that's not going to be obvious, that it's going to be me that gives up my job or not. I mean, take one example. I know one Lutheran pastor who happens to be a woman. And she didn't know whether she was going to be able to take a call, because this is up in Canada, because her husband was rather limited in terms of his employment occupations, and you know, if you're a young Lutheran pastor just graduating from seminary, you go where the calls are. And so they didn't know how they were going to work it out, and her husband decided that he would like to stay at home for a while and take care of the kids, or they don't have kids yet, but yes, maybe they do, I don't really know. But you know, but he'd like to have that role, that he thinks that would be very fulfilling for him. Now that's not domination subordination, it's mutuality, because they've agreed to it, right? It's an agreement that they both think will be fulfilling. She didn't act on her own, she didn't assume he would do that, but they have decided to do that. That's mutuality, and of course it could go the other way, couldn't it? You know, a woman may decide that her most fulfilling mutual position would be in the home, you know. So this isn't saying that you can't have two traditional marriages, that you have to have, everybody has to have dual career. You've heard of two career marriages now, right? Two careers. That doesn't mean that at all. But it does mean that the concerns of each person, the mutuality of each person would be respected. I find it, and I think that our society has said that the woman should sacrifice her all for the man, be known as so-and-so's wife, and then go on from there. And when I talk about this with my students, and they're the young generation supposed to be freed from all the hang-ups that, you know, we're all infested with hang-ups, right? This new generation's coming up that's freed. The only way I can get them to understand what a love relationship would be is to talk about same-sex relationships among friends. Friendship. Because then they can see the mutuality with their good friend, their good buddy. You know, you don't do everything the other person wants, but you work out compromises, right? And you care about each other. And they often cannot see that in terms of men-women relationships. I think that's very, very sad. I'll close with just one story that I think sort of shows this double standard. I was flabbergasted. For a while, I taught at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And that's when I sort of had my little culture shock, when I found everybody didn't yell like we Czechs and Irish and Italians yell. And there was a young man that was talking, and he wanted to serve the Lord. And he was actually talking to one of the colleagues in my department. And he was talking to him, and one of the colleagues in my department said, discouraged him from marrying the woman he was engaged to because she wanted a career. Now, he was going to serve the Lord in an occupation. You know, he hadn't decided which occupation. He was a banker or a lawyer or whatever. But he was going to serve the Lord. And he was to break off the engagement because she wanted an occupation, and that would prevent him from devoting his all to serving the Lord. So he was supposed to find a woman that would serve him so he could serve the Lord. And I kept wondering, what if she wants to serve the Lord in a way that wouldn't be serving you? But that's the kind of double standard that has emerged, I think, and the kind of double standard that would not be consistent with the definition of love I've been giving, unless he would find a woman who really would feel this would be the most fulfilling, developing her potentials, as it could be, as it was, I think, for this man that decided it, who's going to be the pastor's husband. Let me stop here and see if anybody would like to argue with this definition of love. Okay, let's who doesn't want to accept it? Maybe that's a better way of doing it. And why?
It's very threatening to a generation that grew up in a certain cultural bias, that they had roles to fulfill. There was a need for marriage to have families, to populate the earth, and so on.
And there still is that.
Well, not to populate the earth too much. We seem to have an overpopulation problem. But notice, it's not doing away with families or interdependence. It's just saying it ought to be a mutuality and a partnership. When we talk about the ideal wife, I'll be saying what we ought to be concerned about is the ideal family, not the ideal wife. So, It is threatening, but I think, you know, I want you to understand I'm not anti-family. I chose not to marry, but I'm not anti-family. You know, I think that's very...
In this story of yours, is that a true story? The true story of the fellow?
Yes.
Did he ever get on his knees and ask the Lord's guidance in that, or talk to his fiancée about it to get it right?
I wouldn't know that much about it. He told a woman, and she told me. And I believed it. The other fellow had done the same thing, who was my colleague.
What happens when you have a man and a woman respecting totally each other's individuality, and they come to a partner relationship where they can't agree on something, but yet a decision has to be made? And there's really no compromise. Who makes the decision?
Well, see, that I think has to be, that's again, what happens when you and your friend go backpacking and you reach, you know, either we go on tonight or we don't go on tonight. You know, as good friends do, you know, your best buddy. Surely you must have a good buddy, don't you? Well, how do we muddle through those things? Probably you don't decide ahead of time, well, I'll make the decision or I'll make the decision. When I go on vacations with friends, we don't decide that ahead of time. You know, somehow we try to work compromises. Some people in the sense have gone and say, if it's two careers that are causing trouble, well, one time we go with one career, one time with the other. It's your turn, it's my turn. And I think what you're getting at is something that this is very true, in the sense that it was a lot easier the old way. And I think of how easy it used to, and this is hard, because it's not clearly defined, right? And I remember how easy it used to be to date when I was in college. You know, it was so ritualized. It was really marvelous when I was in college and in high school. I didn't do too much dating in high school, but I did a lot in college. And you know, everything was ritualized. I'd come downstairs with my coat in my hand, because I couldn't put my coat on by myself when I was out on a date. I don't know how I managed to get to Casas when it was 20 degrees below zero without my date. But you know, I handed him the coat. He would put it on. When we'd get to the door, you know, my arms would go straight. You know, they couldn't move. And I'd move aside, and he'd open the door, and, you know, he'd get to the car, and, you know, and be the... And everything was ritualized, including to coming back to the parking lot, him making the standard pass and me saying no. You know, and he'd pay. I mean, it was very easy. And now when I go on dates, it's not that easy. Because I don't think he ought to pay. I think we ought to have mutuality. And so it's more difficult, but it's not impossible, I don't think.
In fact, now oftentimes it's even hard to define what the date is.
That's right.
The date was a certain thing, but now there's sort of a continuum about that. So it's sort of a, you know, what is the date and what isn't. There isn't any definition.
Yeah, and those things get to be very, you know, so it makes it more difficult, but I think it's well worth it to have real love.